Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Ruck. I'm Alex Lowe, rugby correspondent for The Times. And joining me today by Zoom is Will Kelleher, who's a deputy rugby correspondent. Now, we're on Zoom, Will, because Alfie, our superstar producer, new YouTube star, is ill. He insists it's nothing to do with going out in Bristol at the weekend with his mate for his mate's birthday. But anyway, we can't come into the Talk Sport studios like we normally do. So we're doing it on Zoom, but we're good. We're rehearsed in this. How are you? How was your weekend?
Yeah, I'm good. Yeah, it was good. Thank you. Poor old Alfie's got no right to reply, does he? But you were saying off air that Alfie's denied him a trip for your son as well, who's going to come in and enjoy the office and everything else.
Yeah, so my son's half term's finished, but he now has an inset day. And the plan was, he was going to have to come up to the studios with me. We normally record this in the Talk Sport studios in the News UK building. And he was actually quite excited about coming to the radio studios and seeing Graeme Souness and Simon Jordan through the glass. But instead, I've packed him off to his mate's house so I can have a quiet house so we can do this. So, Alfie, hope you feel better. And you owe Henry a big day out at the Talk Sport Towers some point down the line.
Trip up the Shard, all sorts. God, it's going to be expensive.
Things, yeah.
But yeah, I'm good. We should stop at this point and say that everyone's welcome for being greeted by multimedia sensation Alex Lowe, who is... I was listening this morning to a rival podcast that you're on in Jersey. You're on the BBC's Rugby Union Weekly, Alex, on your trip to Jersey last week.
I don't think we're rivals, are we? There's room for everybody.
friends.
Yeah, no, I was in Jersey for England had their training camp over there last week, as I'm sure everyone knows. And Friday, we were just standing by pitch side at Jersey Reds watching England train when Chris Jones, our good friend, shoved a microphone in my hand and hit record. So we had a bit of a chat as we watched England training, which was interesting. And it was a good week, actually, in Jersey. We had a good chat with Marcus Smith, some of which we'll listen to coming up later on the pod. And a good chat with Jack Willis, really. First chance to catch up with him since Ross hit the wall. We watched training. And outside of the rugby, anyone who goes to Jersey really has to visit the Channel Islands Liquor Company distillery for a tasting. Now, you and I went there on the Lions.
Before trip. The Lions, yeah.
Before the Lions. And anyway, I did a return visit. It's a distillery down by the harbour, make their own gin, go foraging for local ingredients. Their sort of signature gin has got Guernsey Rock Samphire in it, which is pretty special. And they've also managed to sell rum back to the West Indians. They've got their rum in bars across the Caribbean, which is quite some feat. Selling rum to the West Indians I guess you don't get much better than that. And it's a rum with cannabis in it.
Well, you should say at that point, Alex, that it's the CBD type of cannabis that is legal, the George Cruz sort of supplement cannabis. You weren't smoking doobies in the Channel Islands all week.
No, it is very good though. But it was all totally legal above board. I would definitely recommend it. It's a brilliant experience, and I'm not being paid to say that. It's just genuinely really good. And I I had to change my suitcase into a and put it in a hold on the way back so I could bring some gin back with me.
Nice,
so it was a good
nice.
Week. It was a really good week, and England seemed in good spirits. They trained pretty hard. You can't get a full handle on what's going on, but what you know, you could see some of the combinations. But actually, most interestingly, you know, we used to watch training all the time, and Eddie Jones and England have really restricted it now, which is a shame because you do get a much greater sense of how the team operates. And I couldn't tell you who's going to play in the game against Argentina just from what we watched, but I could tell you who was being influential and just the little conversations that Ben Youngs was having and just the kind of the arm around the shoulders or the G up that Ellis Genge might be giving to a young player like Alan Radwan. Or it was just, you just get a much better sense of how that team functions and who's important and who's taking on what roles and responsibilities. It was a really great experience, actually. And there was, I don't know, maybe 1,000 people watching, local fans and kids on half term. And it was full on. It wasn't full contact, but I'd say it was sort of, I don't know, and it wasn't touch either. It was sort of semi, but it was more than grapple. It was a sort of grapple plus contact, and it was intense. Yeah. And there's no stoppages, and they did this brutal fitness session at the beginning, and it was just good to get back and actually watch them train, which especially through COVID we definitely couldn't do, and these open sessions are great actually to get an understanding of that team dynamic and who relies on who and who who's important.
Yeah, it's a funny time of year, isn't it? Because we sort of at this point start looking in two directions and then fully focus on the Auto International. So on Friday, I was at King's Home watching that, probably one of the last Prem games I see for a little bit, because we just don't have time to do those while we're watching England games on the weekends too. But that was, talking of grapple, that was full bore. That was lots of forwards smashing into each other. Scott Seo, hell of a couple of carries for him. But I think I wrote in my match report for the Times on Friday night into Saturday morning that it's been a long old time since we've seen Gloucester properly looking like they could challenge for the Prem, but that looked like a Gloucester team ready to challenge for honours. They're not at the top of the table yet. Saris are up there. They beat Sale, didn't they, on the weekend in that 1v2 clash, which you were at. But yeah, sold out King's Home, mauling and brawling, and then you've got Lewis Rees-Sammet magic. I mean, I've done some statistical stuff for my Monday More for the Times subscribers about actually the work he did off the ball, which George Skivington was really impressed by. But if you just want on the ball stuff, that assist he gave for Lewis Ludlow in the corner was epic. I mean, the swerve off the right foot, the chicken wing offload out the back, really cool. And actually, on that note, we're talking about multimedia Alex Lowe. Well, it's going to be multimedia Lewis Rees-Sammet soon, I think, because fans won't know where we sit. They know where we sit, but after the games, we go into the sort of media room that's behind one of the stands and near the hospitality areas and changing rooms and stuff. And we spoke to Lewis Rees-Sammet after the match, and following him around was a camera crew, which I wasn't quite aware when I was asking my question, so I maybe would have polished them up a bit better if I knew. but I think the idea is that his management company is filming a documentary essentially about him, following him around for a year, and hopes to sell it to someone in a few months' time, like Netflix or Amazon or whoever else. So interesting. They picked a good game to follow him around with, because he was epic, and the Shed were singing his name and he was throwing his hands up in the air and singing along sometimes. So it was a good Friday night at King's Home for sure.
Yeah, I think Ellis Genge is doing something similar, and that really does play into a long-standing conversation on this pod about trying to get the characters of these guys out there so people get to know who they are off the pitch as much as on it. So that's good to hear. And we'll definitely return to King's Home, and we'll have a proper chat about the Premiership a bit later on the pod. Jess Hayden's going to join us to review England's victory over Australia in the Women's World Cup quarterfinal and look ahead to two big semi-finals coming up. But first, with a bit of help from Marcus Smith, Will and I will run the rule over the Autumn International Series.
Yeah, first and foremost, Manu's a brilliant bloke. He's always looked after me ever since I was young. So as a bloke, he makes me feel very comfortable, makes me feel like I can be myself, and I love that about him. And then on the field as well, he's an absolute beast. He's a freak ball in hand. He's got brilliant hands at the line, and he bangs pretty hard in defence. So it's lovely to look outside and know he's there for you, because he's always got my back, which is pretty special. And I think he adds a fear factor to our team. I know when I play against him, I get that on a Friday night.
That was Marcus Smith talking about Manu Tuilagi. Marcus has been an ever-present in the last year for England, and two of the most important players outside him have not been. Owen Farrell wasn't even in jersey as he recovers from concussion, although he's going to come back into England camp this week. And Manu Tuilagi hasn't played for England for a year since he damaged his hamstring, was it, Will, against South Africa last November. So this idea of England growing their attacking game, which Martin Gleeson is responsible for, you know, Marcus has played four times with Owen Farrell, not even four complete games, and only once with Manu, or twice with Manu Tuilagi, I think. So, you know, so there's a lot for England to try and make work in this autumn. And it is one of the reasons why I'm certainly not as negative as some people about the Smith-Farrell partnership. I can genuinely see how that can really work effectively. Problem is that they haven't really had much time together. And as we have often said on this pod, the single most important factor in that bat line is Manu Tuilagi. Like it or not, and I know a lot of readers and listeners are like, got to move on from Manu, got to move on from Manu. And I understand why, because his injury record means that England are often having to fill a gap there and wait for him to come back. But if they can get that management of him right this year, like they did in the World Cup year 2019, then, as Marcus Smith just said, and as England fly halves have said ever since he made his debut in 2011, Manu's a game changer for what England try and do.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because he hasn't quite been the kind of rhino-esque carrier for Sale this season, but he's looked decent without those kind of marquee runs where he's barreling through about seven different blokes. And we've written and read lots of articles about Alexanderson saying, look, we've got to have him on a different programme to other people. And you hope that a sort of younger coach with a bit of a different look at it, like Sanderson, has finally got there with convincing England to come up with a really good plan for how Manu's managed. Because the only way it's going to work is if he's treated differently to everyone else, which is it's not very rugby, that, is it? Footballers do it all the time, but I mean, it's a very different personality, but I remember the last few years of Ledley King. Do you remember that? When his knees were shot to bits, but he'd never train. But he was a king on the weekend for Tottenham, no pun intended. But maybe that's what they need to do with Manu. Like, why batter him in jersey? It didn't seem like he did too much training, did it, Alex, when you saw him?
No, again, it's only a snapshot. But that one open session, he was doing his own stuff around the edges and wasn't involved in the sort of the physical stuff in the game situation. Henry Slade took a big role in that, and you know, I think that's one of the challenges that England have always had is, you know, I wonder if that's why Joe Cockensinger remains in the squad. I have to say, I thought after he was dropped with Joe Marchant after the first test in Australia, I did wonder whether that would be it for him under Eddie Jones. Joe Marchant stays out, but Joe Cockensinger is still there because he is a player who can provide that physicality if Manu isn't around, admittedly not naturally in that same channel. But England's options there go to Guy Porter, who is, you know, he's a physical guy, but
straight up and down, yeah,
not in the same mould as Manu. Henry Slade, or a Will Joseph, who is one of the players, you know, I just wonder whether we'll see a bit of him this autumn. He got a couple of minutes in Australia, but he's really impressing the England coaches, playing really well, obviously, for London Irish. And again, the bits that you see, he runs. His mannerisms are just like his brother. He's got this sort of shuffle step, and when he makes a break, he has this just the same style of running, the same body language as his brother. And the England coaches were seriously impressed with him on the tour. And again, I understand in the Twickenham camp they had, and he caught the eye once or twice in this session that we watched. So they've got options, but they're all very different. And it comes back to the bang that Marcus Smith just talked about in attack and defence. And if you know, Manu's not the same size he was, that's the other interesting thing. He's a big lad, but he's a slimline version of what he has been in the past. But his reputation's there. You know how devastating a carrier he can be, and it's just about the balance, isn't it? And the variety of options. And England are coming up against an Argentina team on Sunday, where we know exactly what they're about. I mean, they've got some wonderfully gifted wide players. You know, a few of them playing the Prem, the Carreras, for example. You know, great speed, great pace, but it all focuses in on that gain line battle and the brutality, really, of players like Pablo Matera hitting England at the breakdown and
Montoya as well.
Yeah, exactly. Montoya's, you know, who's been brilliant in those exchanges for since he joined Leicester. That battle of the gain line and getting England going forward is critical, because if England can go forward, they've got the playmakers and they've got the pace and the decision makers to make the best of it. It's just been an area where I think they've struggled recently.
Yeah, and actually on that note, another thing that I've looked at for my more thing is the partnership between Genge and Sinclair, which I think is really important now for England. And it's odd, isn't it, to think that the two props could be the playmaking unlockers, I suppose. But I was just looking at a couple of shots. I was having a conversation with Pat Lamb in the week on his weekly press call. And I was asking him about Genge and Sinclair and how they've kind of dovetailed. Because we've watched them, haven't we, for what, 6 years for England when they first went as apprentices to Australia and thought, wow, if you could get them playing well together in a test side, that'd be unbelievable. And the first bit of it really has been this Bristol first month or so. Because actually for England, I was looking earlier, they've only played together, I think, four or five times. They've started a test match together. And actually, it was only till recently that Genge has been starting test matches at all. Has propelled himself to one of the best sort of ball-carrying props in the world. And he's added the scrummaging. But the tries that Pat Lamb picked out, which were really interesting, were two that are an identical setup, where Sinclair stands at first receiver, attracts a defender, and has on his shoulder Ellis Genge piling through a hole. He creates a little dogleg in the defence by attracting the guy, flicks a little tip-on pass to Genge, who smashes through. And people who watch the Prem will remember that happened in about the first 5 minutes of the season when Ellis Genge ran through Barth. And actually that happened about 40 metres out and he still made the line. And then they did exactly the same move against Gloucester in a game they actually lost. But I just think, if England can get that going together as the sort of first point of attack, almost like in an Irish way where they use Tadhg Furlong's hands and put Porter through holes and guys like Ronan Kelleher and all that. If they can get that as the first line of attack, and then behind it, you've already made the yards if they don't go and score straight away. And then you've got the likes of Smith to dance with, Manu outside him, Jack Noel, someone like a Malins or a Thokonasiga if he plays. That is surely a way of England's attack evolving that we've been waiting to see, haven't we? I mean, it's been, last autumn was the one where everyone thought, okay, here we go. That South Africa game, rope-a-dope. The Six Nations hardly saw it at all. Barely scored tries, really, didn't they? Australia was then, oh, we're going to level up the attack. And first test didn't really see that. It looked really clunky. Second test was largely thanks to Genge and his carrying, really, wasn't it? And the forward battle. And then the third test was a bit of a different one. And Smith actually scored a nice try off sort of counter-attack, really, didn't he? But this has got to be the autumn, hasn't it, where they're laying on attack. Although then you had Eddie Jones saying the other day, we don't want to show our hand. So it's a really odd one.
It's definitely an area that they've talked up more than they've delivered. And I think there are factors behind it. I mean, if you build your game plan around Owen Farrell, and we know that they do, Owen wasn't in Jersey, but he was watching training every day remotely and dialing into team meetings and Zoom calls. he's integral to what they do. If he's integral to what they do and he's not there, that doesn't just doesn't help. And then that series in Australia, I agree. Like the first half hour of the second test was outstanding, really, but it became a bit of a battle to just get through the series as winners. And it came down to heart and fight and defensive grit in that third test, which, you know, all of which are massive key qualities. You know, if you want to go and win a test, you've got to have those. And actually we saw Saracens have to fight like a bit like that to beat Sale on Sunday. So England have four tests this autumn to try and show those improvements that they're striving for. Argentina followed by Japan, which replicates their first two games of the World Cup. And then they finish with New Zealand and then South Africa in what Eddie Jones is terming as a mini World Cup to get them ready for 12 months out, which they did the same 4 years ago. We're talking Monday. They're coming back into camp today. And it sounds like, Will, you've got an update?
Yeah, so this is remarkable. And I can't quite believe it, really. So we need to find out some more info when we finish the pod. But two Fridays ago, sitting at London Irish watching them, and Henry Arundel went off to start with, and everyone thought, oh God, here we go. And then, even worse, Johnny May dislocated his elbow, which we talked about last time on the pod. I was with guys in Gloucester on the weekend asking about how he was, and they were saying, do you know what, he's actually training already. And we're thinking, blimey, how's that happened? And it seems like he's going straight back into the England camp, and the specialist has given him the okay to join up with them. So that is remarkable. I mean, actually, it's funny because there'll be, I can't remember his name, but there was a person who tweeted me when I said, oh, look, that looks like he'll be out for a long time, being like, oh, I don't know, don't write him off. That might be premature because it depends how the elbow settles. And I just thought, come on, really? Like, dislocate your elbow? Mm. But fair play to the tweeter. He was right. So Johnny May coming back, and actually the understanding is that Tommy Freeman isn't too far away himself, but maybe might miss the first couple. He's not in a boot anymore for after his foot injury. And similar with Arundel, that he probably could be available for South Africa and New Zealand at the end of the autumn. So there's a chance for the likes of Thokin Asiga, Max Malins, Caden Murley to take a shirt in the first couple, but then knowing then could have two or three top-class wingers coming back to take the spots of the latter end of it. So I don't know, Alex, where would you go? As it seems like Jack Noel's probably going to play the 14 role. And actually, interestingly, after England confirmed our story that they were having names on the backs of jerseys, he was one of the three they picked to show it off, with Smith 10, Genge 1, Noel 14. So that was possibly a play to him playing in the game. I don't know. But yeah, on the other wing, loads of options. Well, I don't know what you'd go for.
There are loads of options. And obviously, if everyone was fit, you'd be looking at Tommy Freeman. He was outstanding on the summer tour. Johnny May has actually been injured or had COVID and missed out on a lot of opportunities. He wasn't at peak form when he was last in the England squad, but obviously he's a class player, and that pace he brings is pretty exceptional. But initially, I'd go for Caden Murley. I see issues or weaknesses in his rivals, which I don't see in him. Like Adam Radwan is quicker, but he's not as competent under the high ball. Defensively, he's less assured. Cochran Singer brings physicality, but Caden Murley's no soft touch, and I just love the consistency about his game. He's a player who is always effective. I don't think has any weaknesses in his game, and the only issue might be that he's similar as a sort of bustling, aggressive winger to Jack Noel. But for Argentina and Japan, particularly Argentina, where it's going to be physical and they're going to have to get stuck in, I'd pick him to play on the other wing. Plus, you know, he lives with Marcus Smith, and they have a natural on-field connection already. So I'd have Noel and Murley in the absence of Tommy Freeman with Freddie Stewart at fullback.
Yeah. I was just going to say that. An innate understanding with Smith. And before they all went away, there was the try that Smith actually scored, but he popped a ball inside to Murley on his shoulder to set the whole thing up against Sale. But it showed how Murley can kind of float around him and just know what he's doing.
Yeah,
I was going to think
sure.
too, is that wrapping up this section, I suppose, what are we demanding then from England? We've had a weird 2022 with England, haven't we? Covering them and not quite sure what they're up to and what they're doing and what if seeing is believing and all that. It's got to be at least a 3 from 4 autumn, I suppose, has it?
Yeah, and actually you look at New Zealand are no great shakes, and I think England should be expecting to beat the All Blacks.
Yeah.
And South Africa won't be at full strength in that fourth test because it's outside of the window, so that there's a handful of players they won't be able to call upon, including like Jasper Visser, Cheslin Kolbe, those guys, basically guys in England and France. I think the Japan players will be available. That's probably looming as the tougher of the four. I mean, famous last words, the All Blacks can click and they can turn things on, but they've had to send some players home injured. Brody Retallick is going to be suspended.
Mm.
You know, I they're still trying to find out who they are. England are still trying to find out who they are. And I think that's, you know, Eddie Jones will look for squad development over results because we know that's how he operates. But if England can win these games, they will, in doing so, start demonstrating who they are and what their identity is as a team. We saw in Australia that they were scrappers and fighters, which they really needed to demonstrate after the Six Nations, where they lost 3 out of 5, they had to show some character, and they did, and that's given them a foundation. I do think there's an opportunity, even you know that injury list notwithstanding, to go and move on and actually make a bit of a mark this autumn, because Argentina and Japan are no easy beats anymore. So I think it's an autumn of opportunity for England that they really have to take.
Yeah, absolutely. Interesting where the others go for it as well, quickly as well. Ireland, South Africa, that's going to be a big one on Saturday night, isn't it? Wales, New Zealand, the train strike, if anyone can get there.
Yeah, there are loads of really exciting fixtures, actually. As you say, Ireland, South Africa, France are playing South Africa in Marseille, which will give everyone a taste of what it'll be like down there for England in the World Cup in a year's time. We'll come on to Scotland, Australia later, but you know they should have beaten the Wallabies. We'll find out more about the All Blacks. It's an exciting period where we can all get lost in Test rugby for a bit. Coming up next on the Ruck, we'll have Jess Hayden, who's been locked into the Women's Rugby World Cup. Joining us now on the Ruck is Jess Hayden, who has been all over the Women's Rugby World Cup, but is probably a bit sleep deprived and bleary eyed after 4 quarterfinals, all in the depths of the night. Jess, how are you feeling? How was your weekend?
I'm good, thank you. I did watch all the matches, so I'm basically about 90% coffee now and struggling through a bit on this Monday morning. But yeah, it was worth it. Some really great rugby, and I think I've successfully transitioned now to being like nocturnal, but still, you know, but now this week having to work in the day is a challenge, but I'm getting there with lots of coffee.
I saw the New Zealand Wales game live. That was a bit more of a social hour. But England through from the quarterfinals into the semi-finals against Canada, which is going to be another middle of the night job. But give us your expert eye on how England did. 41-5 victors over Australia.
Yes, well, the first thing to mention was that the weather was truly horrific and worse than any match that I can remember. The rain was so heavy that every time someone took a step on the pitch, water was flying everywhere. And the sounds, it sounded like sound effects from a cartoon when the players were running, because it was just like...
Yeah, it did. Have you seen the video of Emily Scarrett wringing out her socks at half time?
Yes, it was ridiculous. And they had to change at half time. I noticed they all came out in dry kit, which was soaking wet again 5 minutes later. But I felt so sorry for them. It was an incredibly tough match to play in. I think also a lot of the players have said it was incredibly fun because playing in those kind of wet conditions are fun. And one of the with Australia's only try, actually, the try scorer slid across the try line to score and almost ended up in the stands because it was just like a slip and slide out there. But a brilliant game from England again. It was a lot, you know, they didn't really get the chance to show off the this new playbook they keep promising us about playing through the backs a bit more. But I think what's a really good sign of how well England controlled this match is that they only conceded 5 penalties in those horrific conditions. You'd imagine that, you know, there'd be a very high penalty count. Australia conceded 12. They say rain's a leveller, right? And that when it rains, you might have a chance. I think that maybe that was a bit too hopeful of Australia there. And obviously it didn't end like that. But no, promising signs from England that they can still control the game when conditions aren't in their favour.
Jess, I was going to say on that note of the weather, I remember a minis rugby tournament I played. I think it was at like Staines RFC or something like that. And it was one of those horrible Sunday mornings in March or something, which is horrendous. And I remember it was the days where, you know, you're like under sevens, the dad or the coach actually stands on the pitch and goes, come on, lads, go and tackle the guys. And they made us before the game roll in the mud so that we weren't annoyed about it when it happened in the game. So it's a bit old school, isn't it? I don't know whether Simon Middleton did that for the I was wondering, on a more serious note, and it's one of those sort of hypotheticals, isn't it? But if the weather hadn't been that bad, do you think they would have actually opened up a bit more?
I'd like to think so. So last week, Simon Middleton, well, actually, since the South Africa match, Simon Middleton's been saying that he's been really disappointed by criticism that England are too reliant on their driving maul. And I did an interview with Sarah Byrne this week about that and about kind of, you know, are England too reliant on it? They score a lot of their tries through, you know, line out driving maul, a front row normally pops over and scores. Sarah Byrne is someone who normally kind of is rewarded from that. So it was an interesting conversation. And she said, well, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And Maud Muir said the exact same thing on our podcast last Thursday, except she said, if it ain't fixed, don't break it. But we knew what she meant. I think that we're hoping we see a bit more. I'm not that critical of it, because I think if you win a World Cup, no one, you know, and I think, I can't remember who said this, I think Emily Scarrett said this as well. No one remembers how you scored the tries. It's just that you've won a World Cup. It's incredible. Of course, for fans who are waking up very early in the morning, they might want to see more from their favourite players like Abby Dow and Jess Breach on the wings, and playing it through the hands a bit more. So potentially, we might have seen a bit more if the conditions were better. Maybe just to prove a point that they do have this other way of playing. I think what's quite funny, though, is that Sam Middleton has said, you know, I need to box smart. There are lots of clever coaches going into the knockout stages and potentially into the final. That's going to be a really tactical game. New Zealand in the 2017 final came out at half time and played a completely different style of rugby that they hadn't played all tournament. And it just threw England completely and they didn't know how to react to it. And unfortunately, then they lost their lead and lost the final. So I think it's quite funny that we keep talking, yeah, but we're going to bring out a secret. Because it's not a secret, is it, if you keep saying, but we've got this new playbook that we're bringing out and we're going to use it. So I'm not quite sure. I think that the simple answer is we haven't seen it yet. I don't think the match on the weekend was the time to see it because of the conditions. And I'm hoping that we might see it again. We might see it in the semi-final or the final, but I'm not going to hold my breath because I'm actually really enjoying the style of play that they are playing and they're winning. And I think it's not one for just the people who love watching backs running really fast, but it is amazing rugby to me.
It's an interesting conversation. I saw Ali Donnelly, who wrote the History of Women's Rugby book, Scrum Queens. She was arguing that because this England team are so successful and so good that there's an expectation on them to be perfect, as in to play the perfect game every time. And by that, I think she, you know, it's exactly what we're talking about here, that you play this fast, loose, fluid rugby, but you can also score tries through the forwards and you're this all court team. And so there's an expectation on England to deliver that because they've won 29 games in a row and the gap between them and the teams they've played largely thus far, maybe France excepted, has been so great. The other element which I'm interested in is something that Will and I have heard Eddie Jones talk about. He's got 12 months planning to the next World Cup, and he's already saying that they'll be working on a playbook in training that they don't plan to unveil until they need to at the World Cup. You have to keep things back a bit. And I guess we saw that in the way that England defeated the All Blacks in that semi-final in 2019. A huge amount of planning went into one game. So I wonder whether at the moment, England can play in the way they're playing and they can win handsomely in the way they're playing, knowing that they've got something else in their locker should they need it, or should the game demand it. But also, Ali's point, the expectation is there probably a bit too high on a team that they can't do much more than win 29 games in a row, can they?
Exactly. And what Ali also said was that perhaps they're building themselves a bit of a story here, because when you've won so many games in a row, you're not really ever able to say you're the underdog. So if there's any chance that this is motivating them by the criticism that they're playing one style of rugby, then perhaps that is what they're doing. But you're absolutely right. There is pressure to be perfect and pressure to be entertainers. And that pressure is a big pressure if actually the way that you're winning is through the maul, which isn't that pretty. But it works. They won 11 mauls against Australia and 100% of their lineouts. And those small marginal gains, such as, you know, in the lineout and in the maul, are so important in rugby that it's still impressive. It's just not impressive if you just want to watch the backs run away with it, which is brilliant and we want to see it. And as I say, that Australia try where she flew down the pitch and looked like she was going to end up in the stands was brilliant to watch. But yeah, I think for us as rugby fans and people who support England as well, I would say you want to see them winning, really.
I was thinking of a parallel this morning, and I'm kind of probably the wrong age for this. We maybe should have Stuart Barnes on talking about this, but wasn't it the 91 World Cup final, England-Australia, where for the whole tournament, England were smashing people up in the forwards. And then the Aussies basically baited them into trying to play a more attacking style. And they did, and lost the game in the final. They lost 12-6 in the final. So I wonder whether England just need to stick to their guns, and if they can beat the Black Ferns, who we expect to be in the final with this style, as you said, Jess, who cares if they won the World Cup kind of thing? It doesn't matter. But don't go the other way, right at the last, and then just slip over.
Yeah, do we expect the Black Ferns, Jess? I mean, as outlined in the semi-finals, New Zealand will play France, and England will play Canada. What are your thoughts on those two games and the Black Ferns, maybe the strides they've taken since we saw them play over here and get thumped by England, was that a year ago or so? They look the real deal now.
They do. I think that it will be an England-New Zealand final. Obviously, there's always an upset, and Rachel Berth and I have been saying in the other podcast, there's always an upset and we haven't had it yet. I'm not sure we are going to get it. I think that New Zealand will beat France. I think France have it in their locker to beat them. And I think England-Canada is going to be a fairly straightforward game for England. So, Canada missed 26 tackles against the USA in the quarterfinals. And I think that will be a worry for them. And England will capitalise on that. They've got some very strong carriers and people are able to make very strong line breaks as well. So I think that would be a pretty straightforward win for England and for New Zealand as well. Yeah. And Will, on your point there about changing the game plan, I completely agree. And in the quarter final against Wales, New Zealand were constantly kind of drawing the ball out wide. And if they do that against England, then I think they might find a way to score, because if England are drawn into the centre of the pitch and don't have, and players are drawn into the maul, et cetera, et cetera, if New Zealand are able to get the ball, then I think that there is that scoring opportunity out wide. They have some really, their strongest carriers and strongest players are on the wings, Portia Woodman and Ruby Toohey as well. So I think that will be where New Zealand will potentially look to pick off some easy scores.
Thank you, Jess. And for anyone who wants further in-depth analysis and more chat on the Women's Rugby World Cup, tune in on Thursday for the latest edition of Jess's Women's Rugby World Cup podcast with Rachel Burford.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
Yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two Tiny Women with Gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.
So just before we turn all of our attention to the international game, we should just reflect on another fascinating round of Premiership rugby. Will talked us through the Gloucester-Exeter game that he was at on Friday night, the mauling and the but also the pizzazz from Louis Rees-Sammit. Harlequins had a man sent off, but edged London Irish 26-24 in that local derby. Northampton had Finn Smith making his debut after his move from Worcester, and the young fly half was outstanding as they beat Bristol 45-31. I was at the Stone Ex on Sunday for Saracens against Sale, which was first in the league against second. And even though 10 of the England's Autumn International squad were absent, it lacked nothing for ferocity and physicality as Saracens came from 15-5 down to win it 33-22. It was a momentous day for Alex Goode, who broke the club's appearance record. He was given a guard of honour as he walked out with his son, which included former players such as Michael Liner and Francois Pienaar, and Jamie George was there as he was injured, and the game was being watched by Owen Farrell in the stands, and Alex Goode delivered a performance sort of worthy of the occasion. He scored one try, set up two others, saved a try on the goal line, played 15 and played fly half. Just an outstanding performance from him. And he wasn't alone, really. Theo McFarland delivered another barnstormer of a performance. Just hit the athleticism of the guy, the acceleration, the physicality. And even what you'd see as smaller moments, like his ability, sort of basketball-type skills to go up and win restarts and allow Saracens to stay on the front foot. Just outstanding. Ben Earl, who by many reckonings, including my own, should be in that England squad. He never plays anything less now than an outstanding game for Saracens, and he delivered another. And they'll miss Nick Tompkins when he links up with Wales, because he had a couple of sublime moments, a beautiful offload to McFarland in the build-up to one try, and a brilliant read in defence on his own line to stop Gus Waugh as he darted down the blind side for just as Sale threatened to come back. But Saracens held on. Pretty emphatic in the end, both offensively and defensively, to extend their unbeaten start to the season to 7 games and extend their lead at the top of the Premiership. And even Wayne Barnes got in on the action. At one point, the fans were chanting off, off, off at him after he went in an upright collision with Evan Van Zyl. Only moments after he'd sin-binned Nick Tompkins for doing exactly the same thing. But as we know, Wayne, he saw the funny side of it, and it was a really good occasion. And I don't know, Will, you said that the King's Home was heaving, and I saw the Stoop look brilliant for that game against London Irish, and I've seen clips from the top 14 this weekend, and just the passion and the crowds and the noise that the French game is attracting at the moment. I think there are places in England where we're moving in that right direction, and the Stoop looked a great place to be, and you said King's Home was as well.
Yeah, King's Home was a sellout on Friday night, which is an amazing effort from them. And yes, as you said, the Stoop pumping. I think that's the thing, isn't it? That there's pockets of the Premiership where they're really doing well, and then there's other pockets where it's much harder to sell. And we've talked about this with Mark Evans a lot on these podcasts, haven't we? So the other thing I was talking to George Skivington about after the game, which is fascinating, when we kind of look the other way now for a few weeks, but this is where you make your move, isn't it? In the Premiership, the next 4 weeks or so, there's one round where they're not playing, when England are playing the All Blacks. But if you can pick up a few nice 4-point, 5-point wins over the next few weeks and get into Christmas intact, then you're halfway through the season, you're doing well. Just looking at some fixtures now, and you've got Northampton playing Exeter next weekend. You've got Saracens going to Bristol, who won't have Genge and Sinclair, which are a big miss. And then after that, you've got Sarries Northampton. You've got a Gloucester Newcastle. So, and the Quins Gloucester in a few weeks' time too. So, for those teams up the top, now is the time to make your move, I'd say.
And what's also fascinating is that the players, where some of these Wasps and Worcester players are ending up. So Exeter are going to lose Luke Cowan-Dickie to England, but they've just signed Dan Frost from Wasps, who's a really good player, and you know he's not Luke Cowan-Dickie, but he gives them a great alternative when they lose their first choice England hooker. Leicester will lose Andre Pollard to the Springboks. They just, as we've been recording this, just signed Charlie Atkinson from Wasps. So they will, you know, they won't suffer as badly. And we, you know, we spoke earlier about Finn Smith. You know, if Dan Bigger ends up leaving or going to Wales camp, they've got another, you know, really exciting young fly off there. So I think that there are teams who are recruiting as well to boost their depth, so they can try and make a move during this period. So when we come back and really turn our attention onto the club game, you know, post autumn we go into Europe and then back into the Prem. We'll see who's made these moves. Now you mentioned Mark Evans. He's moved down to Fiji now to run their Super Rugby team, and we will have him on again. But he has left a mark on this. He's left a legacy on this pod because we've for the last few years we've ended every episode with the God or Goddess of the Week, and he one week decided that we had to. He just couldn't see enough positivity and brought in the Devil of the Week, and so we're going to round off this pod with our God or Goddess, but I am going to go with the Devil. I think we need to make sure we reference a few gods and goddesses, which we will. But just going to start with Australia at Murrayfield. So Australia sneaked that win. Scotland should have won the game. We all know. But the stink that Australia kicked up during the Rugby Championship after they were penalised for time wasting and missed out on the chance to beat the All Blacks at home, you'd think they might have learned their lesson. But if you go through that game, the number of penalty goals that they took, which way exceeded the time limit. I mean, you're allowed 60 seconds from the moment that you indicate going for the posts, and they were taking 80, 90 seconds to take a kick. You would think that they might have learned their lesson if they're going to kick up such a stink at being penalised for it. It obviously hasn't worked, so maybe we should round the officials into this one as well. But if we want the game to speed up, and we defend the referee for punishing Australia because they were dragging their heels at the end of that game, we've got to follow it through. And there were at least two occasions where Australia landed penalty goals that they shouldn't have been allowed to take because they ticked over the 60 seconds. So that has to be sorted, and bring in the shot clock, and or at least if you're going to get pinged for time wasting, maybe learn your lesson from it.
Yeah, what I actually did like in that game was right at the end, the cleverness of Nick White, who was the chief guy who was annoyed with Mattia Rinnell about that time-wasting decision in the New Zealand game a few months ago, who Blair Kinghorn missed that kick that could have won Scotland the game, but White then had the dropout and knew there was only a few seconds left and the clock had gone dead. And what he did was, instead of kicking it out on the full, which would have been a scrum against, he just grubbered it into touch. The Scottish team didn't really realise he was going to do that, and that was the end of the game. Yes. So it was possibly gamesmanship.
That was smart thinking. I think the whole subject of time wasting. So I blame Australia and I blame the officials for not following through. That's they get a devil mark for me this week because we know it's a blight on the game and it's so easy to correct, and it's just being allowed to drift again. So Nick White, smart. The rest of it, a negative devil mark for me. Will, who? Let's finish on a positive. Who would you put through as the as a god or goddess?
Yeah, so I think if we were going gods, I think Alex Good the God could have been mentioned for his 10 millionth and fourth appearance for Saracens. Played really well at both fullback and fly half, didn't he? Yeah. In that game, yeah. So he was sensational. So hat tip to him. Hat tip to Lewis Rees-Sammet, as we mentioned earlier in the podcast, with his film crew and everything else. And a hat tip to Alex Mitchell too, who's scored a couple of tries and just permanently is involved in good stuff that Northampton are doing. But we can't leave the pod without nominating the Goddess of the Week. and one of the goddesses of all time for England, really, Sarah Hunter, who broke Rocky Clark's caps record in the quarterfinal, won the quarterfinal, 138 test matches, which is remarkable. And by the time she played her 140th, she could have won the World Cup. So incredible achievement going from amateurism to professionalism and all the way through. And there was a nice piece with Elgin Alderman tracking her career and talking about actually she's not a great dancer and stuff like that. So have a read of that if you haven't on the Times. But yeah, goddess of the week, Sarah Hunter.
Not a great dancer, but a pretty decent number eight.
Class.
I heartily endorse that nomination for Sarah Hunter. What an outstanding servant and representative of the game she is. Will, thank you. We've battled a few gremlins, but we've got to the end of the ruck. We will be back in the studio next week to review the first full round of the Autumn Nations series. It'll be the day after England face the Pumas at Twickenham. This has been The Ruck from the Times of Sunday Times. Please follow or subscribe from wherever you get your podcasts. And this episode was edited from his sick bed by Alfie Reynolds.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.